9208 here on All Local All Day, 1330 WNTA. Good afternoon, Mark Mayhew. Again, our producer, Howard Bailey Murray. He's on the other side of the glass. Your call is always welcome at 1-815-874-TALK, 874-8255. The mayor of Rockford has proclaimed Amateur Radio Week, with the Amateur Radio Field Day taking place June 28th and 29th of this year. And we have four amateur radio operators here with us today, and they're identified as W9KTQ, KE9NJ, K9LLL, and KC9IED. So they're all present and accounted for, I guess. Are we? All right, Carl, let me ask you first, what is amateur radio? What is the difference between amateur radio and other types of radio that people are aware of?
Well, amateur radio has to do with a class of radio the FCC has licensed or permitted to be on the air that is for non-for-profit, and it's to benefit the local communities, to be assistance in case of emergencies, to increase the radio art, experimentation, and also fellowship and goodwill amongst not only people within the United States, but also between countries.
How long? It's been a long time, but when was the first amateur radio license issued? What year was that?
I think that was 1934. I think 1934, yeah. Congress enacted the Amateur Radio Service.
Put that just a little bit closer to you there. Okay. And but before then, there were still people doing basically what would be considered amateur radio, though, right? I mean, there were still people
as early as 1913.
Right.
Okay. How? And I know there's somebody spoke about it last week. The relevance of amateur radio today. We, you know, 1930s, we understood things going on. How relevant is amateur radio today with all the technologies we have, with the internet, with phones, cell phones, whatever? How relevant is amateur radio for today?
Well, generally, in any disaster, amateur radio is the only type of communication that gets out today. When you have a large disaster, cell phones generally become useless because the circuits are all tied up. Regular communications will fail, and no matter where the disaster hits, if it's a tornado, flooding, hurricane, within a short period of time, and I'm saying within hours, amateurs in the area generally set up communications and radios and can communicate anywhere locally and also throughout the United States and world.
Ed, let me ask you, youth and amateur radio, What piqued your interest in amateur radio?
Well, at Christian Life High School.
Okay, for some reason. Oh, is it not working there? I'm. Okay, wait a minute. Hold on. Let me get this moving. Try this. Okay, go on. Nothing. I tell you what. I'm gonna have to apologize here. Can you share a mic with Carl? Whatever, real quick here. I'm sorry. That one always give us some problems here. But, Ed, again, we're talking with Ed Polno, who is a youth and amateur radio. Ed, what was your impetus to get involved in amateur radio?
At Christian Life High School, in which I attend, last year, I believe, I don't remember, early on the school year, my sophomore year, we had an ARISS contact, and we made contact with the International Space Station, and we got the chance to ask questions, and I was a part of the group. But actually, I didn't get a chance to ask my question, but I got to tear down, and it was really neat to see all the equipment and all the effort and time that was put into it. And I had always had an interest in some sort of alternate communication. When I was younger, I wanted to do CB, but my dad would discourage that and kind of lean me towards ham radio.
Do you have a code license? Do you have a no code license? What kind of a license do you have?
Well, right now the FCC dropped code
altogether. They dropped altogether.
Yeah. So okay. I have no code.
Well, Carl, let me ask you real quick here. I know you had to learn code. What was the importance of code as opposed to voice transmission?
Well, the code transmission years ago was the most sure transmission. That is, voice transmission didn't go as far and was not as clear. But code transmission is basically a form of the digital transmission that you translate in your head. And that would get through where voice would not go through. But today, with all the digital modes with computers and such, they found that it's not really necessary to have the Morse code as a requirement. But a lot of hams still use it today and enjoy it.
Let me ask John Cotner again, the KC9IED. John, I can move the microphone here just to... you're the emergency coordinator for Winnebago County. I know there are trained storm spotters, and I know the amateur radio community is very helpful when it comes to spotting storms and alerting the National Weather Service. How does one go from being an amateur radio operator to being a trained spotter and utilizing the amateur radio service to do that?
Okay, the spotter training is available to any citizen who wishes to participate and support the National Weather Service. Amateur radio operators have the opportunity to use their license and their skills to support. All it requires is that you have a license, technician or higher, that you have completed the training, which is provided in March and April of each year across the northern part of the state. We offer the training at the Rockford International Airport in conjunction with the Winnebago County ESDA each year, and it's free of charge. It's a four-hour training program, and any person who wishes to familiarize themselves with the essentials of weather spotting and the reporting criteria and so forth that are required, they may attend.
What, as far as you're concerned, what is the relevance of amateur radio today? As we talked to Carl before, there's cell phones, there's internet. What is it about amateur radio that's still relevant as far as you're concerned today?
Well, my interest in amateur radio has been pretty much lifelong. I only became an amateur radio operator 3 years ago. What stimulated and really gave my interest sort of a kick in the pants, if you will, was the events of 9/11 and the belief that amateur radio communications are probably the most effective and efficient form of communication that you can have for your family, for your community, and for your, for the government, for that matter. Mm-hmm. There are many instances, as Carl alluded to, where the infrastructure has failed due to electrical failure, wind damage to towers, flooding, etc. Amateur radio is unique in that the operator and his own gear, his skill, his ability to choose the right portion of the spectrum, and battery power or generators makes us totally independent of that infrastructure.
Let me ask Carl Erbisol here. Carl, the question regarding, one thing I remember up in the early 90s, there were operators out there who would be able to take phone calls from folks from the overseas in the first Gulf War and translate them over. Does that still go on today? In the amateur radio community, where instead of using a cell phone to go worldwide, you can take a phone call from one place and through amateur radio, take that to somebody else's locale, home, so somebody could talk to their loved ones via amateur radio. Is still going on?
Yeah, that still goes on, and that's one of the things. Regardless of the technology that we have, cell phones can fail. There's a lot of things. No matter what kind of technology you have, you always have the possibility of it not working in a disaster. And so there is still traffic that's being handled that way. And it can be, whether it be from a foreign country to this country or even around the country, we are trained to handle traffic. And that's part of our amateur radio services, to be able to relay those messages. That was actually the backbone of why Congress had the amateur radio service. Their definition of it is they wanted to have a group of skilled, trained radio technicians to be able to handle traffic, whether it be internationally or just with this country, in case of an emergency.
Now, does amateur radio includes transitions on AM and FM type spectrums? Is that correct?
Right. It can be AM, FM. It can be also a modified form of AM, if you want to call it that, called single sideband, which gives you more of an effective distance as far as your signal can travel. So there's a lot of different forms, actually. There's digital forms now, radio teletype, and it goes on from there. So that's the point, really, is in our training, you learn to use the right format for the conditions that you're presented with.
You talk about that, and I'm a big shortwave listener, have been since I was a child, and when I first had a radio that would receive single sideband transmissions, there was a shortwave station out of somewhere, maybe Quito, Ecuador, or whatever, that would broadcast sometimes on single sideband, which was great because the regular frequency you could barely hear them, single sideband you could. But the problem is with single sideband, when they started playing music, it was just like, you know, it's not for music. I mean, it's great for voice, but music is just such a thin thing there. But it was very interesting that I could hear them a longer distance on a single sideband frequency than I could if they were broadcasting on that same frequency without the use of single sideband.
Right. In fact, now they have digital modes such as PSK31, which a lot of people will use. And that is even more effective than radio teletype. And a lot of this came from purely experimentation with amateur radio operators. They before PSK31, they went to PACTOR, AMTOR, and all these things. And what they did then is in the program itself, in the computer, and the way they would send this information, there was error correcting then, so we didn't get errors. And now it's even gotten more refined, whereas PSK31 is a very reliable, it doesn't require a lot of power, and that can get through in a lot of, staticky conditions, whereas other things will not work.
220 here at 1330 WNT. We're talking about Amateur Radio Week in Rockford. Our guest, Carl Cacciatore, Kurt Eversall, Ed Polno, and John Kottner. Kurt, continuing on this, anyway, if anybody has any questions, 1-815-874-TALK, 874-8255. Kurt, there is the field day operations coming up. For those who are not familiar with field day operations, what is that all about?
Field day is a exercise, and what it is for us as amateur radio operators to simulate non-standard working conditions. In other words, we go out to some place and we're going to simulate the fact that we have to have our own power available. We have to erect antennas, portable antennas, to be able to operate. And so this is a training that we have that happens every year. And so we learn to operate under a somewhat simulated, whether it be an emergency condition or non-emergency, but be able to transmit and communicate out in the middle of nowhere sometimes, and sometimes that will absolutely happen. So that's what we do, and our annual field day event is being held in Aldine Park on the 28th and 29th, which is Saturday and Sunday. And so we'll be there, and you set up your equipment. You can set it up in a tent, any kind of shelter, whatever it may be, and we have generators running for power, and you make contacts with other stations throughout the U.S.
I used to know a friend of mine who was involved with this in the past. Now, this was, talking about late 60s, early 70s. They would have sometimes contests where they would shoot a signal north against the northern lights to beam it back south in order to see how far you can go. Do you do things like that also?
We don't typically do that in field day. However, there are so many aspects in amateur radio. There are people that will actually take their signal and bounce it off the moon and have it come back, and they will communicate that way. So that's one of the things with amateur radio is there's very varied ways to communicate. You can bounce your signal off the moon. You can use the ionosphere to communicate with other countries, which is what we call HF operating. A lot of people do that. Locally, people operate through a repeater. You can also operate, of course, with the digital mode. So it's a varied type of hobby, and there's something for everyone.
223-1330 WNTA. Sam has called that number. Hello, Sam. How you doing? I lost him there. Let's go to Jim on line two. Hello, Jim. How you doing? Welcome.
I'm doing fine, gentlemen. This is Jim Dorsey in Freeport, KC9 at GCR. And I've been a ham for exactly 4 years. And I know I've talked to a couple of these individuals before. In fact, Ed, I was your first contact, you know, out at the Ham Fest in Belvedere.
So your Jim was your first contact. Kurt was your first contact, huh?
Yes, actually, Ed threw out his call. He just bought the new radio and in HD or something, and he threw out his call, and I got back to him. I happened to be there at the Ham Fest.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, hey, Jim, thanks for the call. Appreciate it, sir.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You bet. 224-1330 WNTA. Hello, EJ. How you doing?
Hi. Thanks, Mark. Greetings to your guest. And I have a question, and then I have a little story for you.
Right.
Do the two-meter operators gather at a certain frequency on a certain night of the week?
Yeah, go ahead. John, do they gather at a certain time of the week here? That's okay.
Sorry about that. The Aries Amateur Radio Emergency Service has a net that meets on Thursday nights on 147.255. It has a 118 point... I can't remember the offset. Sorry. Plus 600 offset. If you wish to check in on that net, there is a website you can find. It's Winnebago County, Illinois, Aries, A-R-E-S, and the contact information is located on that website.
Is that at 8 o'clock on Thursday night?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Okay, thank you. Yeah, when I was a child, I built a Star Roam receiver from a kit, and... I got a Heathkit VFO and a Nightkit T60 transmitter, but I got so bogged down with everything else that I was doing that I never learned the code. And I always used to go to the commercial tent at the 4-H fair on West State, and the local group of hams would set up in that booth and talk to people all around the world. And Bob Schmoke was one of my favorite people. And you guys remember any of that?
No.
Well, okay.
No, unfortunately.
Just wanted to tell you my story. I really appreciate what you do. I was listening one time when a guy says, "Did you get it, Vern? Got it. Did you get it, Roger? Got it. Didn't get it so good over here." He turns his beam over and broadcasts all the way from, I guess, Canada to California. And he says, "This is a fax copy of a picture of a 1947 Chris Craft yacht that I rebuilt, and there's an inset of the all mahogany dashboard." And he was sending that over the airwaves. I was just amazed. This was over 10 years ago.
Wow, that's amazing. Hey, EJ, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it, sir. All right, 226 here at 1330 WNT. We'll take a break in just a moment here. Let me ask you this, Ed, real quick. I only got about a minute here, but what kind of a outfit do you have? What kind of rig do you have when you broadcast?
I just have a two meter mobile. That's what I do right now. And everybody says, "Well, why don't you decide to get your upgrade or get your general license class, or you should do this and do that." And it's kind of the interesting thing is when you read about articles and things like that, there's so much that the hobby has to offer that it's hard to make up your mind.
All right, well, we'll continue our conversations again with Carl, Kurt, Ed, and John here, talking about Amateur Radio Week in Rockford here on 1330 WNTA. CNN News coming up back after that. High 233 here on All Local All Day, 1330 WNTA. Talking about Amateur Radio Week, and again, the field day coming up this weekend, I believe, over at, was it Aldine Park, is that right?
Aldine Park.
We're speaking with Carl, Kurt, Ed, and John regarding Amateur Radio Week in Rockford. Carl, there is also amateur television, amateur radio TV. How does that work?
Well, amateur radio TV is, again, by amateurs, and we have a TV station or a repeater station located on top of St. Anthony Hospital. And if you have a outside TV antenna and you put your TV on cable 57, you can point your antenna towards St. Anthony Hospital. You should be able to see amateur TV right there. There are several amateur TV stations in town that communicated with each other through television. Also, you have utilized amateur TV on some of the races and like the rowing competition on the Rock River and some of the other races, charitable races. We've hooked up amateur television, and so people can see the event, the start and the finish, and not be right there. And so,
what frequencies do you use, and how does that look compared to, say, at least typical analog TV now?
That is regular analog TV today.
Mm-hmm.
It is not digital TV, it's analog TV.
So it wouldn't look any different than if I turned to another channel as far as the picture quality and all that was concerned?
No, it wouldn't look any different.
All right. Let me ask, John, some statistics here. How many people are involved in amateur radio, as far as the United States and also in Illinois, how many people are involved with amateur radio?
In the United States, as of yesterday, we have 657,981. Now, in 2007, I was not able to break out statistics for women, but in 2007, there 15% of the total number were women. In Illinois, as of today, we have 22,504. Now, I understand those are soft statistics. It's changing continually. We have 40,000 licensed amateurs in the amateur radio emergency services nationwide. I don't have a statistic for Illinois. In Winnebago County, however, we have 43 mm-hmm. registered amateur radio operators.
Where do you like to see yourself, amateur radio, say, a few years from now, 4 or 5 years from now? I mean, it seems like you're... the bugs bit you there. Where do you like to go with it in a few years? What would you like to do?
Just continue to pursue as a hobby. Some of the new digital stuff that's coming around is really neat. Like PSK31, it's basically like a very complicated form of IMing, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. It's kind of neat. With the whistles over your with radio waves, you can type to people halfway around the world. Maybe stuff involving HF contacts, and I don't know. It's like I say, there's so much that is changing and growing, and that it's just kind of neat to see and what can happen and what you can be involved with.
Kurt, what are some of the protocols as far as civilities on amateur radio? I mean, what are things you're able to do, what things you don't do on amateur radios when you're on, as far as with people speaking on the same frequency, what are the rules of the game on that?
Well, of course, the FCC has the Part 97 rules, which gives you the operating frequencies, the power, the emission levels, and things like that. But as far as amateur radio, you're really dealing with it just like you are on a personal level. There are certain issues that, of course, that you don't necessarily always discuss on the air. It all depends on who you're talking to. But you have to keep in mind, of course, that we live in a culture, and amateur radio is part of that culture that, we have the ability to communicate, and we communicate throughout the world. We can go and talk to someone maybe in South Africa or Europe or wherever it may be. So you have to be aware of some of those things. And so generally it's just discussing like we would be discussing right now, actually. Mm-hmm. When you get into more of the details, maybe if you talk to them in person, one of the things that they have is every year in Dayton, Ohio, is a gathering, and quite a few amateurs go there, and that's actually when you may meet someone face-to-face, and then you can go into a little more relevant subject, so whether it be governments or education or something like that. But typically on the air, you're dealing with things just like what you would normally do in society here, and just be aware of the fact that your culture isn't necessarily their culture.
Is English a universal language in amateur radio, or does it depend?
It is the universal language in the respect that everyone, especially when you're dealing with a voice operation such as single sideband, you must identify in English, regardless of your country, or your recognized language of that country, you have to identify yourself in English. Now, after that point, if you want to speak German or French or whatever the dialect may be, you can go ahead and do that. But every 10 minutes, you have to identify in English.
Mm-hmm. I know that in Antarctica, they have an amateur radio base there. If I had an amateur radio, depending on the frequency, can I speak with people in Antarctica from here, or does it take a little finagling to make that happen?
No, you can do it. In fact, there was a in McMurdo Sound. There was a fella, and he very typically would be on usually about the same hour every day or every weekend or whatever it may be. And so it was very easy to have the contacts. One of the issues, of course, is the ionosphere, which carries the HF propagation throughout the world and allows us the ability to communicate throughout the world. That's the master. So, you know, we have to do it. The ionosphere is only going to let us do on a particular day, and there can be some ups and downs based on the ability to communicate because of that. But if the ionosphere wants to cooperate with us, yeah, we can talk whenever.
What of sunspot activity? How does it affect what you do? I'm sure in certain frequencies more than others.
Right. It is frequency related. Right now we're actually coming out of what they call a sunspot minimum, and that's a 11-year cycle. So about 5 years from now, 6 years from now, you're going to have a maximum. And what that allows you to do is the ionosphere will stay ionized longer during the evening. and that carries the propagation or your signal to other parts of the world. So there would be many times when you have a peak like that, that you can talk to someone all for hours, actually. Halfway around the world, Australia, New Zealand, wherever it may be. Right now we're at a minimum, and what that narrows the window is what it does. Some of the frequencies you cannot operate with, but there are others you can, and it just narrows that window. So you learn, that's one thing about the ham radio, is you learn a lot about electronics, you learn about rules and regulations, and you also learn a lot about weather and propagation and how the world works a little bit.
241 here at 1330 WNT, talking about Amateur Radio Week in Rockford again this weekend, the field day, Amateur Radio Field Day over at Aldine Park. Carl, when did you get involved with amateur radio? How long ago was that?
Oh, a little over 30 years ago. I was something I always wanted to do when I was probably a teenager and never really did it. And I was in my 30s, and I decided, well, it's something I'm going to do. So I bit the bullet and knuckled down and got my first license.
Probably open up to anybody who wants to answer this. You can make it as expensive as you want. For somebody starting out, how inexpensive can amateur radio be? What's something you can do that at least you're considered an amateur radio operator but not have to spend maybe a lot of money up front?
Well, today, if you're starting out, there's a lot of decent used equipment out there, and just for a few $100 you can get on the air and be able to communicate if your interest is locally. If for like 2 meters and local communications, you can probably do that for under $100 on used equipment. If you wanted to talk around the world, it might be $200 or $300, you know, for the minimum that you'd have to spend.
Before I follow up on that question, Jim is called 874-8255. Hello, Jim. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, guys. Oh, back in the late 40s, early 50s, I was very interested in that amateur radio and had gotten a Heath kit. And we're putting it back and forth, you know, tearing it apart and building all these different types of electronic equipment that you could with it. But it was pretty primitive. And after about 3 or 4 assemblies, a lot of the components, like the wax condensers, they had been soldered 2 or 3 times, and they would start to melt. So, in addition to that, they had their own coating on the resistors and condensers and so forth, so you couldn't even replace them with, you know, standard equipment that you could buy somewhere else. I also had an amateur radio operator, W2IXJ, that he had a big trunk full of equipment that he used to broadcast on, and he used to come in and knock off the TV station and the radio stations and everything else when he was speaking on his rig that he had back there. The good feature was he went home every night at 5 from his flooring store that he was operating, so it didn't interfere with anything at night. But it was quite an experience. He was really, really powerful. Even today, they put a new tower in out at Colonial Village. And I guess the police radio is on there now. And on Channel 19 on the cable, where they have the program guide, I pick up the police radio operator. The squad car that she's talking to is nearby. I can pick him up, too. Sometimes I don't get the audio, but I do get the sound bars in the picture, you know.
Mm, how about that?
Yeah, it's a... Well, I'm sure other people in near that tower are having the same experience as I do.
All right.
But it's only restricted to Channel 19 on the cable.
Hmm. All right. Hey, Jim, thanks for the call. Carl, and follow up on that, and Jim brought this up a bit. How different did you own equipment that was generator tube operated at one time? And I was going to ask anybody, what's the difference between the old days with the tubes and today's with the integrated circuits, and is one better than the other?
Well, yes. The old tubes, in one respect, were more rugged than the integrated circuits are. But you can do so much more, and so much more filtering, so much more technology you can build into a radio because of the smallness of size. And with the tube sets, you couldn't do that. It was just way too big. The same thing, too, that, you know, your prior caller said about receiving radio signals off the TV set that was hooked to cable. Well, he should never have that happen to him. And the only reason that has happened, somewhere in the cable line, there's a break.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as there's a break, the signal's getting in. And if the cable company would repair the line, he would not get the signal.
Real quick, before we have to go a break here in about 30 seconds, I was always understood that if there was anything back in the old days of the Cold War, if there was a nuclear blast, that transistors would not work, but tubes would. Is that true? Anybody aware of that? That's why I heard that if there was something going on, if you had a tube radio, at least you would be able to send out something, but transistors you wouldn't be able to.
Well... If there was an absolute disaster, I don't know exactly if it would really matter in the big picture. However, I can tell you that one of the things is that the new technology is great. We have DSP, which is digital signal processing. It allows you a lot more flexibility in what you can do. However, they are more sensitive. So in a certain respect, if something would fail from, let's say, lightning damage and a strong magnetic force, yes, it would be an integrated circuit, whereas a tube might be more reliable in the respect of it's more rugged, it's more robust.
Mm-hmm.
As far as performance would go, no, the newer equipment, of course, just allows you a lot more options.
247 at 1330 WNTA. We'll take a break back and more regarding Amateur Radio Week in Rockford with Carl, Kurt, Ed, and John right here on All Local All Day, 1330 WNTA. 2:52 here at 1330 WNT, wrapping up our show on Amateur Radio Week and also the Amateur Radio Field Day, which is at Aldine Park. And again, the coordinator is Kurt Eversole. Kurt, what kind of equipment are we going to see if we go there? And again, I know it's open to the public. What will we see there when we come there this weekend?
Well, what you'll see is I'm going to operate actually out of a portable trailer, and a lot of people will do that. There's also going to be a tent there. And when you go into there, and by all means, you can come out, ask us all sorts of questions. We'll be glad to answer your questions. But I will have the radio set up. I may not be operating. There's going to be about 5 different operators that will take turns, obviously, in shifts and making contacts. But we will have that up in the trees. You'll see some wire antennas. Typically, we use wire antennas. And that's one thing with Field Day is it teaches you how to improvise, too. It's very easy to get into somewhat of a rut that you don't think out of the box, if you will. And Field Day will teach you how to think out of the box.
Well, one thing I asked you during the commercial break and that you're doing, you're going to be making your own antennas for this weekend.
Right. We'll be making, normally, that's part of our training is to be able to take a situation and be able to communicate regardless whether it be raining. The only thing we don't do is if it's lightning, we will not operate. It can rain, though, but as long as it's not lightning, we will operate. But that's what it teaches you to do. You make your own antennas. You can improvise. You operate maybe out of a tent. And if one generator goes down, we also have another backup generator, and that's part of the training.
For somebody who comes and they say, well, geez, I'd like to get into this, how difficult is it to take the test and become an amateur radio operator?
It's not difficult, and I think if I gave anyone some advice, it would be that we have a local club in Rockford called the Rockford Amateur Radio Association, and we are the sponsor of this field day at Aldine Park. Now, we also have a website, and it's w9axd.org. Excuse me, w9axd.org. And if you go to that, there is information there concerning our club meetings. Carl, he puts on classes, and maybe you want to comment on that, Carl. But it's not difficult to get involved. There's a lot of people that will help you. All you have to do is ask.
Carl, what kind of classes are involved in learning to be an amateur radio operator?
Those interested in becoming an amateur radio operator, we hold our classes in conjunction with Rock Valley College. And you sign up through Rock Valley College. And we offer both the technician and general class licenses. They go 2 Saturdays for each license. So 2 weekends on technician will go from 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. And then on the second Saturday, they will go from 8 in the morning to about 2, and then from 2 to 4, you'll take your FCC exams, and you can walk out of the class and be a licensed ham. And the way things work now with the FCC, it used to take weeks or months to get your license. You'll be able to go out to the FCC website Monday morning or Tuesday morning and get your license.
All right. Hey, again, Carl, John, Ed, and Kurt, thank you so much for your time. I sure appreciate it. And, again, look over at Aldine Park this weekend and talk to these folks if you're interested and see what happens from there. Again, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, 256 here at 1330 WNTA. Back in a moment. All right, 259 here at 1330 WNTA. Our guests, again, are thanks to Carl Cacciatore, Kurt Eversoll, Ed Polno, and John Cotner joining us here. Coming up, CNN News Top of the Hour. And then, after that, in local news with me at 3 after, it's Rockford Talking with Bruce Butler on All Local All Day, 1330 WNTA.